Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Gott in Himmel, which is, of course, German. For crikey, Fritz, this battle isn't going too well, is it? And welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, the podcast that's healthily obsessed with the Second World War. Nobody does dastardly Nazis like we do. 80 years on from the most important battle in the history of the world, and James Holland and I are still talking Battle of Britain for a third and final week. I mean, we were going to do one, weren't we? And then we said, but there's so much unfinished business, and now here we are, completing the triptych. Though, if we ended up talking about this next week, I wouldn't be surprised. Would you, James?
No, probably wouldn't be surprised at all. Not surprised at all. And Gott in Himmel, actually, I mean, I know it's strictly speaking it's German, but really it's Commando Ease, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is really, isn't it?
And
yeah.
Ach, Mamma Mia! Yeah. When you're Italian. And what's it in Japanese is Banzai!
Especially, Banzai and aye, aye, Tommy Pigs. Okay. Today, though, we've set ourselves a challenge where we're going to try and answer a stack of remaining questions. So we'll limit the time on each, or try to, and rattle through as many as we possibly can. We're going to try to do that.
Won't work.
It's what we're going to try to do. First, a few bits of news. Gurglebox was another big success last week. We spent an hour drooling over the brilliant third episode, Quarantine. It was good, wasn't it? It was really, really good. I mean, it just strikes you how beautifully made Banner Brothers was, doesn't it? The whole thing.
Yeah,
just
it is. It also made me feel a bit nostalgic. It says quite a lot about me, I think, when I get nostalgic for going to Normandy, when I see kind of lots of people being blown to pieces. But you know, that I completely forgot to kind of show everyone that that then and now of Carentan, central square. And just off there is where the little cloisters are, where Winter's got nicked and stuff. And it's brilliant. It's just so exciting going around there because it has been rebuilt and it's quite a nice town. You've got the usual things of the bars and the patisseries and all the rest of it. But you've got genuine World War II Band of Brothers history there spot.
There.
And, it's a great place to visit.
Yeah. Well, the next Gurglebox will be in a few weeks' time, but of course we're back live streaming on Thursday at 8:30 as usual.
Yes.
I've got a couple of actual gigs this week. I've got a gig in Battersea Arts Centre on Friday night, and then on Sunday.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. Nature's returning. I've ordered my plastic face screens because I have to wear a face screen on stage so I don't spit on anyone.
No way.
Which I am prone to do. So when I'm really going for it. So
So does that mean you've got to sort of chop the hair off and stuff?
I'm not going to cut the hair off. I'm going to call it a COVID miracle that my hair's grown back. You know, it's an ill wind that blows no one any good. So I don't want to lose this hair. It's beautiful. I keep catching sight of myself in the mirror or in windows and go, who the hell's that? It's very odd. Anyway, we've got some brand new book recommendations for August for you. So if you're looking for something to read on your staycation, give one of these a try. We've got independent company members £2 off each book from Waterstones. Check out the members' site for details. They're up to date with links on our Patreon site. We Have Ways Patreon. Independent company members, if you buy all three, you'll basically get your entire month's membership for free, for nothing. And the books are London War Notes by Molly Panter Downs. This is a fantastic, fantastic book. Basically a diary of impressions of what the war was like to live through.
Yes, because she's living sort of just outside in Surrey, isn't she, somewhere in the country, or Sussex or somewhere, Midhurst sort of way, or Hazelmere. Yeah. And she's going up to London regularly, and she's writing these for the New Yorker, isn't she, magazine.
Yeah.
It's for a kind of an American audience, but they're just brilliant. They're so sort of insightful and incisive. And funny, really funny.
And funny, but also, I mean, the early war stuff, because I put one up on, there's a little bit of it on the Patreon that we did.
Yes.
And what's very interesting about that I did for the day that it was written about is there's really interesting stuff that, given the endless comparisons of the COVID situation to the Second World War, endless and inevitable, there's the really interesting stuff she writes about people's response to the blackout. Well, because when people get antsy about having to wear a mask in public places, she's saying everyone's complaining about the blackout. They're trying to bend the rules. They're looking for the gap in the regulations. They're all mithering and moaning and saying, well, why should I have to do this? Well, it doesn't affect me. And it's the same. And that's what I think that's what's really interesting is that and obviously these are being written for, like you say, for public consumption, but she's prepared to warts and all on a thing like that, and I think that's really interesting in itself. Yeah. That she's prepared to admit that, but also that's the thing she's reporting, that that at the time no one was going round saying, oh, we're all of united of one purpose and everyone's on the same page. The government wanted that of people, but they didn't necessarily get it. And no. I think that's really, that's a fascinating insight. Then there's the I don't know this next book, The Lion Rampant.
Change? I read this for when I was doing my Normandy book, and it's just a brilliant memoir. And it was written, I think, in the early 1950s, so pretty close after the war. And you can sort of tell it's got a kind of real freshness to it. And it's based on his diary anyway. And it's the, it's Normandy and beyond. It's an infantryman who lands just after D-Day. And he's in all the big battles, and it's just, the bewildering sense of chaos, the casual violence. He's a beautiful writer. It's really good. It's right up there as one of the very, very best memoirs I've read of action in Northwest Europe in 1944-45. And I just couldn't recommend it more highly. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. Not long, it's not a big book, but it's just beautifully written.
Yeah.
And then The Last Enemy, Richard Hill.
Oh, what a book this is.
What a book. Written in 1942, published in 1943, 44, I think.
When was he killed?
He was killed in 43 or 44, so it came out around the same time that he was killed, I think.
It came out a little bit after because he got some...
I think it came out in 1942 because he recovered. Because basically, he's a Battle of Britain pilot, and he's incredibly good-looking, incredibly dashing. All his posh mates from Oxford are all kind of, they're a beautiful new generation that are going to, they're going to run
gilded,
the country.
Completely gilded youth.
Completely gilded youth who are going to kind of run the country in 25 years. And his best mate Peter Pease gets killed. There's a big picture of him actually, incidentally, in the RAF Club painting of Peter Pease. Yeah. Anyway, so he gets killed. Various others, Noel Agazarian, who flew the Spitfire along with John Dundas, that's in the Imperial War Museum. Anyway, he gets shot down in his and gets very, very badly burned. And he's one of Mackindo's guinea pigs.
Gets very
badly disfigured. And he's very bitter about it, very screwed up about it, has to go and do a sort of war bonds tour of America, hates it. Comes back, he's determined to fly again, should never have been landed anywhere near an aircraft, gets inside a Blenheim and crashes it and kills himself and his navigator.
But I remember reading this, when I was a kid. And there are some very, very striking passages in it. There's a bit when he's going on and on about being on a saline drip, and he's on the saline for ages.
Yes.
And there's a bit where he hears a nurse in outside his room go, shh, that boy's dying in there, be quiet. Tries to quieten down some noise in the corridor, and she says that. And he hears that and thinks, no, I'm not dying in here. I'm not going to die. And that is absolutely, when you read a bloke's personal account of that, and this is, I think what's really interesting is he does write this in the flush of it happening to him, rather than 10 years later, rather than 20 years later. It's not like a Paul Brickhill thing, so it's gone through someone else, which, because the Paul Brickhill books of the 50s are the sort of famous first time round accounts, like Great Escape, Dam Busters, and all that sort of thing. In lots of ways, it's raw. It's a lot like Keith Douglas' book. It's written between one action and the one that takes his life, really, isn't it? It's an extraordinary book, this.
It's beautifully written. This is a guy who really has an instinctive understanding of how to write beautifully.
Yeah.
And obviously not everyone has that. And very few people have that. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful book. And he's rightly fated as...
Yeah.
I mean, it's right, you know, that and I suppose First Light are the two great books of memoirs that have come out of the Battle of Britain. And until Jeff's book came to the fore, you know, The Last Enemy was kind of stood alone. I mean, it is it's an absolute classic.
Yeah. So, London War Notes by Molly Panterdowns, The Lion Rampant, Robert Wilcombe, The Last Enemy by Richard Hillary. £2 off each book, buy all three, and that's your membership paying for itself. You can't say fairer than that, independent company members. Put that in your ration pack. Okay, it's time to get up in the clouds. We're going to try our damnedest to rattle through these Battle of Britain questions as quick as we can. Nick Brown and Taker Twinstra ask similar questions. Nick asks, just how seriously did the German army prepare for Sea Lion, or was it just a case of going through the motions? And Takey asks, did the Germans ever do any serious planning for an invasion of the UK, like preparing landing craft, selection of beaches to land, etc.? Anything that could even remotely compare to Overlord? Well, I think you could answer the last bit first, and no, it doesn't remotely compare to Overlord.
Not remotely, but they did do loads and loads of preparation. They kind of moved divisions up to the front, they had loads of training going on. They moved loads of Rhine river barges into the Channel ports with a debilitating effect to their own industry, their home industry, because, of course, the Rhine kind of feeds the Ruhr and all the rest of it, the industrial heartland. It's a big, great thoroughfare, so you know they really couldn't do without those barges, but they did for a bit. And the army were training and doing these landing exercises way through into 1941. Actually, and part of that was because it was a useful exercise to do with new recruits, and partly that was because they wanted to give the British the impression that they were still trying. It was kind of part of their deception plans for Barbarossa. But I do remember talking to this guy called Franz Marson, who was a lovely chap. He was a baker from Dusseldorf, who ended up being a machine gunner, being wounded twice in the Eastern Front and then in Italy and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I remember him saying to me, he said, the thing is, James, it said, after Zivor, I was I actually finally got to Britain. I went on a channel crossing and I turned to my wife as I saw the white cliffs and I said, we would never have made it with those cliffs. And I said, so why on earth were you still doing these invasion exercises in sort of April 1941? He said, first the invasion. So as far as they were concerned, it wasn't off at all.
Really?
Yeah. Well, obviously it was, but you know, that's what they were told. They, you know.
Well, I mean, after all, I mean, there's an awful lot, when we talk military planning, there's an awful lot of need to know goes into military planning in all directions. So, you know, what you needed to know if you're, to pick an example, if you're, say, Spike Milligan in your battery training to defend the UK, well, what do you need to know? That do you need to know it's off? No, you don't. No. I mean, if you're a German infantryman, do you need to know it's off? No, you don't. The thing is, there's serious planning for an invasion, and then there's serious planning, isn't there? And by the time of Overlord, what's happened is that it's the Allies. The Allies have tried Dieppe, which is the one that gets hung up on. There's been Torch as well. And of course, Torch isn't really against a serious adversary. And there's some political sort of chicanery going on to try and make sure that the French don't resist.
Sicily.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's Sicily. And then there's Salerno. And, you know, Anzio. All these things. And Anzio. All these things that have happened before D-Day that feed into the D-Day planning. And it's... it constitutes a spoiler for anyone who's going to get the Sicily audiobook or the book, is there can be... There, failure isn't an option. They cannot countenance failure with any of these amphibious landings. Whereas the Germans haven't done one before. They've never done this kind of thing. Whereas the British actually have a history of descent, amphibious descents, they were called, where the Navy takes a marine somewhere and dusts up the locals and seizes it from the French, which is the old style. And so the Germans have no history of this at all. So no matter how serious they plan, it's probably not serious enough.
The big problem is they don't have joined up thinking. So and don't have joined up planning. So, you know, they've got the OKW, which is this combined services general staff, which is really a very sensible idea, but they didn't use it in the right way.
Yeah.
You know, so they've got you know, everyone's going off doing different plans. The Luftwaffe's got its plan, the Navy's got its plan, and there's just no joined up thinking. And what's really interesting is, you know, sort of Britain, most British people were sort of living in fear of kind of sort of fear of paratroopers, German paratroopers, sort of peering in the sky.
Yeah.
And there were posters, you know, up going, these are what German paratroopers look like. You know, if you see one, run away. and I mean, literally, I mean, it's quite a famous picture, quite a famous poster. Yeah. And Goering, even in the middle of September, hadn't decided whether he was going to allow his Fallschirmjäger to be used. I mean, it's just absolutely extraordinary. So, in answer is yes, they planned it, they prepared it quite seriously, but they certainly didn't prepare for it seriously enough. And and I would argue that even if they thought they were preparing seriously, it wasn't seriously, and it certainly wasn't enough to be able to put it off. That's for sure.
Yeah. Now, Michael Vicks asks not a question as such, but talk a little about Tom Neill, if you can. Always interesting when I've seen him interviewed or read about in your books. I mean, you're a major Tom Neill fan, aren't you, James?
Well, I just got to know him very, very early on in my research, and I've known him I've known him probably best part of 20 years before he died. And he was just always, you know, we always got on really well. He was lovely. He had served in Malta, so that was why I originally spoke to him. But I sort of got his whole life to him. And then I filmed with him a number of times. And you know, I just regularly kept in touch. So I used to go and see him quite a lot, and I got to know his sons and family and stuff. And actually, I did his eulogy at his funeral, at his memorial service. So, you know, which was, you know, a singular honour and all those sort of things.
Yeah.
And he was just a lovely, lovely chap. He had that, a lot of the British fighter pilots had this, actually. They had a real sort of twinkle in their eye. You always got the impression that they didn't sort of take life too seriously, that they kind of sort of worked hard, played hard.
Yeah.
I don't think that is an entirely a myth. As I said last week, you know, he had that great ability to kind of analyse his experiences. So I remember him talking about the ineffectiveness of bombing of airfields. And he says it was like our first day at Northfield. He said it was the 3rd of September, 1940. We all took off, all 12 of us took off in our Hurricanes. And he said, you know, 15 minutes later, I looked down over Northfield. The whole place was being attacked by Dornier 17s. And he said, couldn't see the airfield at all. The whole place had completely disappeared in clouds of dust. And I thought, how on earth am I ever, ever going to get back down again? And I said, well, obviously you did. Because, you know, we're talking now. And he said, oh, yes. He said, it wasn't a big problem at all. He said, by the time we landed back down, the smoke had cleared and we just dodged the potholes. And it was just kind of, you know, it was a sort of case in point that you can just, you know, this is what you can do. You just, and this is why it was so hard to destroy a fighter command airfield, because they're grass. They're kind of, you know, 100 acres plus in size.
Yeah.
You need a hell of a lot of ordnance to kind of knock one of those out, to make it completely unusable. And because there's no runways, you would obviously take off into the wind, you know, take off into the wind and land into the wind. So, you know, it didn't matter. You could orientate yourself any way you liked, and you can land anywhere you like pretty much. So a lot of them were kind of sort of, you know, they were enormous. Well, so you didn't have to just sort of go down the middle. And you know, Dowding and co. had thought about this beforehand. So had prepared huge piles of sort of scalpings and soil and stuff.
Yeah.
And bulldozers and graders. So after every attack, and they kind of whistled in and just filled them in and just rolled them all out, and you just crack on.
It's interesting, isn't it? There's a lot to be said for the grass airfield capable fighter aircraft, isn't there?
I mean, yes, there is.
These are high performance planes, and they're quite capable of, you could basically land them anywhere that's flat.
Yeah.
Can't you? I mean, that's quite interesting, isn't it? And then when you get onto tarmac runways and steeled runways, the things get more complicated, don't they? That airfields are a juicier target as a result. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Matthew Wilkins. What did Tom Neill do after the war, by the way? Did he stay in the IAF?
Yeah, no, he stayed in. He was a test pilot, so he went back to Boscombe Down. Which was where he was when James Nicholson got the Battle of Britain's only VC. He went back, he was a test pilot. He ended up doing, he did some sort of diplomatic job, I think, in the RAF. And then I think he was doing something to do with cars and PR in America.
Right.
I can't remember, but you know, he stayed in for quite a long time. You know,
he would have flown everything then if he was a test pilot.
He flew literally everything. Literally everything, yeah. I mean, he hasn't quite got the kind of 465 aircraft that Winkle's got on his log with Winkle Brown, but he's got, you know, he got a heck of a lot, you know. And he moved from kind of sort of biplanes to fast jets, you know, and did all that kind of stuff. So, you know,
the way the people in that generation did, which is incredible, isn't it?
And he knew all those guys, you know, sort of John Derry and all those people, kind of Rowley Falk. He knew them all. you know.
Right. Okay, Matthew Wilkins, we're actually managing to do this. Matthew Wilkins says, if German intelligence was much more accurate, I think he means if it had been much more accurate,
yeah.
No Beppo Schmidt making up as he went along, could this have had any impact on Luftwaffe tactics and the outcome of the battle?
Well, it certainly had an impact on Luftwaffe tactics because they'd have known what they were attacking and what they were doing, and they'd have come up with a better plan to deal with it. Would it have had an impact on the outcome of battle? Well, yeah, probably. Not overall, but it would have played out in a different way, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it would have gone on longer.
It would have gone longer. I mean, but, you know, it doesn't alter the fact that they didn't have enough to do what they would... what they were trying to do.
And we go back to what we were just talking about, that you can attack as many grass strips as you like, yep. but the other thing, if the smoke hadn't cleared from where Tom was trying to land, he could have gone up the road somewhere else anyway. Kenty's one enormous airstrip at this point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Essentially.
Well, he was in Norfolk, which is now in Essex. But I mean, yes,
but in Essex. But you know, whole of that part of the East Anglia, the whole of South East England, East Anglia is one enormous airstrip. So even if they, because yeah. after all,
so the, I mentioned numbers of that they had on. I think it was the 4th of August. I told you what they got. So this is really interesting. So on 6th of July, the Luftwaffe has 750 single engine fighters, and it has 1,200 bombers available on that particular day. Yeah. By the 28th of September, has 276 single engine fighters left, and 750
really?
Bombers.
Oh, that's not
Stuka's
good.
Completely gone. So it's gone from having, you know, 2,500 aircraft available to 1,200 available on any one given day in total. Just not enough. It's not enough. Whereas on the 6th of July, the RAF has 644 single-engine fighters. By the 28th of September, it's got 732.
How many aircraft did the Luftwaffe field on May the 10th?
They had about 3,500 available to go.
Right. So that is
attrition.
A punishing summer, isn't it?
Yeah.
And let's say, I mean, you know, if we're going to be counterfactual for a moment, let's say they've won the Battle of Britain by this point, right?
Yeah.
With that rate of loss, and they now mount an invasion. There's absolutely no way the Luftwaffe can replicate what it was doing as a tactical air force the way it did in May, is there?
No.
So the Heer can't depend on the kind of tactical air cover and integration that it would need to operate in the way it's become used to tactically and doctrinally in Poland and then in France. So either way, they've come undone in that respect. So,
yes,
so an invasion.
Fact, and that their losses are so bad in the summer of 1940. The aircraft production has slowed so badly.
Yeah.
That by the beginning of Operation Barbarossa, the following June, and let's say it's the third week of June, they still don't have as many aircraft available as they did on the 10th of May 1940.
Goodness me.
Because don't forget, they've still got the Blitz to go. And they've still got Greece, and they've still got Malta.
All these things yet to happen.
So it's just a trip. So their aircraft production is not keeping pace with their losses, which is really bad, which just goes to show how parlous the aircraft industry is in Germany by that stage. Because obviously, the only reason why they've got more aircraft in 1939, 1940 is because they started earlier at a greater rate. But Britain is massively outstripping them by 1940.
This also shows, doesn't it? You know, that we've got Germany is doing the things it has to avoid doing. It has to avoid getting into attritional situations because it doesn't have the depth to meet them and to face them. Has it? Hasn't it? But it's in that situation. They've got themselves into the situations they desperately needed to avoid. Because the leadership can't think further than 3 weeks ahead, basically, is what's happening.
Well, it goes back to what we said before, that the whole way of the German way of war is to get your victories really quickly. You get them in.
Yeah.
You know, Battle of Britain is supposed to be over in 4 days. You know.
Yeah.
From the launch of the Adlertal Eagle Day.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be 4 days later, done and dusted. you know, the blitzkrieg in France, you know, that's all about kind of winning in a matter of weeks. I mean,
yeah,
you know, the whole thing is designed for this short, sharp battle of annihilation.
Yeah.
So the moment they start getting into a kind of attritional, long, drawn-out war, that's when it all starts to creak.
They're in trouble, yeah. Okay, we're going to take a brief break now. With more of your questions, I've got a question that's been bugging me that I need to ask after the break, actually, which we'll come back to. We'll see you in a tick.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, "Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school?" Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, "I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii." Okay. And I looked at him. I said, "You're done." I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. James Holland and I are talking about the Battle of Britain again. I mean, you're not stuck in some sort of lockdown time warp where every day is identical, but we are talking about the Battle of Britain again. But before
we do... Makes me feel very happy.
Before we do, I think this wouldn't be this podcast without a digression into the subject of Normandy. James.
Shamelessly so.
Well, you posted an article the other day on your website on Griffin Merlin about how there should be a new way to make Second World War documentary history, which is a conversation, which is some cud we have chewed on here a bit privately. Because we do, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, we do talk to each other other than on the podcast. We're not like some boy band who've been stuck together by an evil producer who never spend any time in each other's company otherwise.
Yeah, fucking alien.
The Milli Vanilli of history. But your program Normandy 44.
Well,
I've had a
slightly frustrating time because you know, the whole point. So basically, I sort of sat down with this guy called Richard Lake. He's a wonderful fellow, and he has a couple of Spitfires, and he's the guy who paid for the Canadian Lancaster to come over a few years ago. Do you remember it came over for the summer?
He just said,
"God, that was really good of you." And he said, "Well, you know, I could," and I just thought, "Why not? It'd be nice to kind of, you know, for everyone to see it." But anyway, so he was saying that, you know, how fed up he gets with watching what he calls the crap on telly, because he just felt that it was either kind of dumbing down all the time, and he couldn't bear the whole kind of repeating after every ad break, and he couldn't bear the fact that it was either kind of huge sort of someone doing up a Spitfire or something, or some sort of gizmo, or Ewan McGregor and his brother flying around in a Mark 9 Spitfire in a Battle of Britain documentary, which makes no sense whatsoever and has no relevance at all, apart from kind of the annoyance of watching someone having a really nice time in a Spitfire. Or he says, you know, you just get these kind of narrator-led, lots of archivers' wallpaper, kind of a few kind of sort of He said ugly academics, kind of, you know, talking. And you know, we got chatting and we kind of felt there was a different way of doing things and, you know, a way of doing things cheaper. And I always felt that you just, you know, whenever I've done films in the past that have been, properly commissioned, it's just so frustrating because you never have the time to do everything. Everything's got to be kind of sort of stripped down and stripped down and stripped down all the time. Yep. You never get to the nitty-gritty. Yep. So I said, well, you know, wouldn't it be great to actually go on, you know, walk the ground and actually talk about it in depth? And I said, you know, it doesn't have to cost the earth because we're not going to buy lots of archive. We don't need that. We've got, you know, and I said, instead of having veterans who now are getting a little bit long in the tooth, those that are still alive, let's use contemporary voices. Let's use diaries. Let's use memoirs that were written, you know, like Robert Walcombe, for example. You know, he's just after the war. And get an actor to read it and put that over lovely kind of general views of kind of the Epsom battlefield or whatever it might be. Anyway, so we made it. But obviously, you know, we made it for a kind of a fraction of the price that you would normally expect for an hour's... I mean, I'll tell you. I mean, you know, an hour's documentary, you know, on BBC Two, you're looking at kind of, you know, 175,000 quid, something like that. I mean, I think we were making those for about £40,000 each, episode. So, and still having high production values. I think that is the key. I think people expect it. They want to know stuff that they don't know. They want high production value, so you want all that kind of what you would call post-production, which is where they do all the grading and the colouring and making sure all the sound is consistent and all that stuff. That's actually quite an expensive process, but we did all that as well. But anyway, so it's now on Amazon Prime, finally.
And it's on Amazon Prime.
Well, the frustrating thing was that normally it takes 2 to 4 days to upload onto Amazon Prime and you know, it's a very good deal. You get that whole platform and all the rest of it. But because of COVID, it took 120 days.
Congestion and everyone elbowing their way to the front of the queue.
Stuff. So it's been very frustrating, but it is now on there and it's called exactly the same as the book because it was based on the same research. And, you know, the whole idea is that if you've kind of read the book, you might be interested to see what the battlefield looked like now.
The place looks like.
And all that. So, you know, and the aim is to do the same for Sicily. You know, with you and I kind of going over and chewing the cud. Me taking you around some of the places that you've been reading about.
Yep. Well, I can't wait. I've got load more audiobook to do today. So, but fortunately, the invasion has started. Thank God. Right. Okay. So,
finally, how are you liking Gavin though?
Well, he's an interesting character, isn't he? I mean,
he hasn't got any bridges to take.
No, he hasn't got any bridges to take. But this sort of self-conscious, I'm going to have to talk about this another time, but the different martial cultures on display in different people's memoirs and the approaches and attitude to war are fascinating because he is a sort of self-styled Spartan holy warrior in a way.
Totally.
Gavin.
Yeah.
Whereas the Brits are like, oh, well, if we're going to have to bloody fight the bloody Germans again, they're like, I mean, the reason cliches exist after
is
all
because is because they're true.
It's because they're true. And the Germans are either we will do the Führer's bidding and fight to the last round, or they're the classic, like, reluctant soldier. Well, I must fight, so be it. And I'm really going to have to make the best of a bad situation. I've been let down by the people at the top. And the different martial cultures on display in those personal accounts are fascinating. But they're not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the Battle of Britain.
Yes, but so, just wait till you get to Dante Ugo Leonardi.
Well, I can't, you know. The Italian battalion commander,
he's just hilarious.
The Italian martial traditions, of course, which is something else. Right, anyway. Now, I want to ask this question, but then I want to talk. There's a thing I want to talk about that goes with it. Zach Wood says, I've always wanted to know what was the top scoring squadron during the battle. Mm. I've read several books and they each seem to vary in statistics. What was the top scoring squadron?
I think it's the 303 Konieczko squadron, the Polish squadron. I don't think there's much debate about that. I mean, the 609 squadron based at Middle Wallop, they were the first to get to 100. But obviously they were in it from July, so, you know, they were there. They were engaging the enemy on the 8th of July, for example. So even before the Battle of Britain officially begins. But I think it's the 303 squadron is the number one.
Right. Right. Well, because the thing that comes away from this that I want to talk about is famously during the Battle of Britain, in fact, during the Second World War, you have claim and counterclaim. Whatever's in the newspaper that day about what happened in Deutsche Beobachter or whatever, or in the Times, Volker Schubert back to the Times.
Yep.
They're wrong.
Yeah.
The newspaper reports are consistently and regularly totally wrong, aren't they? Right? But James, I can see James on Zoom. He's just produced a vast slate grey volume from low down in his bookshelves. Right? But the governments do this, and they do this for good reason, which is, of course, to keep everyone's pecker up. Right?
Yeah.
They've got to say that the enemy sent... Well, what they have to say routinely is the enemy sent less planes than last time because the enemy is losing.
Yes.
We shot down more planes than last time because we are winning. And we lost less planes than last time because we are winning. Yeah. And obviously, you end up with this. And Victor Klemperer writes very well about this, about how Nazi superlative language degenerates to the point where it becomes meaningless. So the enemy was annihilated yesterday. He writes this sort of thing. Well, in the paper they said that the enemy was annihilated yesterday. Well, then why are we still fighting him today? Russian forces were totally smashed at this place. Well, then why isn't the war over? And what's the gap? At what point do governments go, maybe we've over-egged the pudding here, we're being irresponsible? And what do they the other thing is what do they actually know? Because squadrons are reporting back, if you've got a shared kill, five people have shared a kill, it could be the same plane, it could be two planes. They may not have actually shot anyone down. The guy might have got back across the channel. At what point does the Air Ministry know the difference between what the RAF squadrons are claiming, what the Luftwaffe are actually suffering in terms of losses? Because this is a key component of how the battle's presented in public.
Yeah. So what happens is you get the immediate kind of sort of, the sort of early exit polls, which gives you a kind of sort of vague idea. And that's where you get the kind of sort of, 176 shot down or whatever it was on the Battle of Britain day, 15th of September, which is nothing like it. And that's because that's the immediate response.
Yeah.
Then... people get then they have to check their gun camera footage, which obviously you don't necessarily do on precisely the same day, not for everyone, particularly if there's been a big melee. It can take a little bit of time to get through all that, so then clearer picture comes. Then there is analysis of downed aircraft as well, so you're starting to get a pretty good picture within a matter of days. But obviously for the newspaper headline you want it by kind of 5 o'clock the afternoon before comes out. And after that, well, there's no point correcting it because it was quite high, so it doesn't really matter. Then subsequently after the war there is then painstaking work, and that's why it's producing this hefty tome, which is for anyone who's interested in the Battle of Britain, this is just an absolute have to have purchase. It's not a book that you can read cover to cover, but this has got detailed analysis of every single plane that was shot down or damaged in the Battle of Britain, and it is widely considered to be the last word on this. So when I've been spouting statistics at you, it comes from this. When I was doing my Battle of Britain work and on the book and everything, this is the book I used. And quite often I was having to go through day by day and adding up and counting and kind of going, okay, that's that, and double-checking and all the rest of it. And that's where you get your figures from. And those are very, very accurate. And I have to say for the same, it's the same with the Germans. The Germans, you have to, before you get officially awarded your kill, you have to kind of, you have to talk through your after-action report. It has to kind of compare with others and all the rest of it. What the reason why they have these experts who are sort of knocking down zillions, like sort of Adolf Galland and Mulders and all the rest of it, and Helmut Vick, is because once you start becoming the top scoring ace, you are basically, your job is 100% to just shoot down as many aircraft as possible, and everyone else is there to protect you. So you're not worrying about who's on your ass. You're just homing in on that because you're the squadron's best shot. And there is a kind of sort of very good practical reason for that. Because if you're the best shot and shooting down aircraft is incredibly difficult, then you might as well be given the best chance. Think of it like the striker in a football team. You obviously put him up front and you feed him the ball so he can slot them in the net. It's sort of the same kind of principle in a way. But the British just do it in a different way, and obviously they're in a defensive battle, so they're responding to a situation rather than going after people. The interesting thing about the 303 squadron is that there's a number of reasons why they are the highest scoring. One of them, of course, is because They get in very close and they shoot them down. You know, they're very aggressive pilots.
Yeah.
And they've got that kind of sort of, you know, I hate you, you bastard, I'm going to kill you kind of attitude, which a lot yep. of RAF pilots just don't quite have for all sorts of yep. very obvious reasons. The second reason is there because they're in Hurricanes, and so therefore they're attacking mainly bombers, not entirely, of course, because it's not as simple as that. But for the most part, they're at lower heights operating against the bombers, and bombers are easier to shoot down than single engine fighter planes. The third reason is because they're operating from Northolt from the beginning of September 1940, where suddenly that's when the change happens from the 7th of September, where suddenly you've got a mass of aircraft coming towards London every single day rather than splitting up all over the place, which yep. makes them harder to shoot down and more, you know, there isn't that
harder
sort of
to vector onto and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, harder to vector onto, but also the number of targets is less because you're attacking a raid of sort of 10 or 15 rather than a raid of kind of 300. So those are the three reasons why. It is a lot to do with Polish bravery and skill and all the rest of it, but it is also happenstance of the stage of where they're based and the time they come into the battle and the planes they're operating.
Yeah. Okay. Glenn Towler asks, do you think the bombing of Berlin really changed the course of the Battle of Britain, or would the Luftwaffe have started bombing London regardless of what Bomber Command did?
That's a really, really good question. I don't know, but I don't think they would have attacked as early as that. They were definitely goaded into the Battle of Britain. I think they would have probably carried on attacking the airfields. I don't think it would have made any difference because they weren't attacking the airfields very successfully. I mean, yeah. you know, it's important to understand that when we're talking about, you know, attacking the airfields. I mean, this is quite interesting. So let me just very, very quickly talk you through what happens on Thursday, the 15th of August, 1940. So this is when we're still at the attacking the airfield stage. This is two days after Eagle Day. So between 9 o'clock and 10:30, there are reconnaissance operations by Luftwaffe in formations of about six at a time, and none of them intercepted. Then between 10:45 and 11:30, there are 30-plus enemy aircraft are picked up on Home Chain, which is the longer-range radar at around Cap Grenet, moving from Cap Grenet. Scrambled for that are 501 Squadron 54, 56 and 615. 11:29, enemy crosses the coast near Dungeness in two formations and then turns north. 501 Squadron meets 20 plus Stukas and six ME-109s at 10,000 feet. So that's 26 enemy aircraft, which is, you know, it's not a lot, really.
No.
You know, that's not a lot. So that's 12 attacking 26. That's not massively outnumbered by any stretch of the imagination. But they are able to attack them out of the sun. So that they have that advantage.
Yeah.
So that sort of negates the numerical loss, I would say.
Yeah.
Second enemy formation engaged by 54 Squadron attacked 40-plus ME-109s at 16,000 feet. So 12 against 40 109s. That's quite a big tussle. And that's not very good. But the Germans scatter and turn back to France. They've run out of fuel. So the moment they're attacked hard, they're just like, well, we're off ski. So that they're gone. So that doesn't really achieve anything. Meanwhile, 40-plus Stukas and 40-plus ME-109s, they drop bombs on Dover, Hythe, Folkestone and Hawkinge. Dover's not really doing a lot. It's a port, you know, but that's no airfield there. So that's that. There isn't one at Hythe either. The only serious damage from all that is on Limp, which is an airfield, which is just, you know, just a little bit to the west of Dover.
Yes.
So Luftwaffe are attempting to hit forward airfields in Kent, but only one received much damage, which is Limp. Two of four squadrons scrambled, successfully intercepted. Later on, there's Luftwaffe 5 attacks from the north, which we talked about the other day.
Yeah.
Five squadrons scrambled to meet those. 12:45, 72 squadron engaged, blah, 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 blah. You know, and that's sort of basically it. You know, and that's it. So overall, some 200 enemy aircraft attacked in several waves, inflicting little damage, except to Bomber Command airfield at Driffid. That's the one in the north.
So
and then between 2:30 and 4:15, Dover and the Thames. This is the third big operation of the day. So the first operation is that kind of little scattered sort of, you know, in the morning. Then you've got the one in the north, which we talked about, that attack on Driffield, which Cocky Dundas is involved
badly,
in and all the rest of it. Yeah, it goes very badly because they're not escorted. Then between 2:30 and 4:15, you've got Dover and Thames Estuary, third big operation of the day. Enemy plots picked up, 30-plus in Calais area at 14:14. 15-plus enemy aircraft at Saint-Omer, which is bombers. Then 50-plus by the time they're approaching Limp at 15:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
228, 20 plus north of Saint-Omer, and 100 plus in the Straits, and 50. So what they're doing now is they're sending over several rays, each of kind of sort of 50 to 100 at a time. Yeah. That's a bit of a nightmare, to be honest. And that's sort of it. That's it for the day. And they don't, again, they don't really achieve a huge amount. You know, so, you see, so the whole thing, there's a lack of focus, there's a lack of Schwerpunkt, there's a lack of kind of, you know, it all sort of, you know, don't really know what they're doing.
Well, which brings me, like, sort of tangentially to the big wing. You know, the Germans aren't doing big wing, are they?
No, but well, they sort of are, because they're massing 50. The trouble is, they're massing 50, you know, if you mass. Okay, so that's really interesting. So you've got those, you know, 50 plus ME-109s. Okay, so, okay, they're all in the Pas-de-Calais area. So they're all in airfields like Calais, Grease, Calais Marc, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They're all fairly close together. But you've got to take off, then you've got to form up.
Yeah, yeah.
Before you've even set sail, it's kind of half an hour's gone.
Yeah.
Then you've got to get across the channel. Then you've got to attack. You've got your 10 minutes. Then you've got to bugger off back again. I mean, it's just... The problem with the big wing is the time it takes to form up.
Yeah.
Which then means the time you've got in the combat zone is really, really small. You know, the most effective way to attack airfields is to send in a few, like half a dozen Junkers, and followed by half a dozen, you know, ME-110s and 109s with bombs to just go in low under the radar, come in and all the rest of it. But, you know, for example, on the 14th of August, I think it is, you know, Middle Wallop is attacked by a lone Junkers 88.
Yes.
Causes a huge amount of damage, destroys a hangar, kills lots of ground crew, all the rest of it.
So
it's probably shot down. Yeah. You know, so it kind of, therein lies the rub.
But that, so what you get from it is whatever they do, they don't, I mean, we talked about this the first time around, whatever they do, they don't have the weight to be able to do it.
They don't have the weight.
In a Schwerpunkt, in a knockout blow.
No, so they end up having to do this sort of scattered approach. And the scattered approach is good because it's much more confusing for fighter command to respond to. But it's also not terribly effective, because the scattered approach means you haven't got enough on any one thing, which means you then end up having kind of, you know, 20 Dorniers attacking North Weald and putting it under dice, but they all, you know, but it's just repaired again. So whatever, you can make yourself more effective to take on the British air defence system, but in so doing, you then lack the punch.
Yes.
To get the punch you need takes too long, and you therefore also lack the punch, because you're not over there long enough. You know, it's not effective enough. So whichever way you do it, you know, if you want to destroy a city, you need 3,500 heavy bombers over kind of, you know, conditions.
I was just going to say, this is a problem that takes Bomber Command 4 years to solve. Three years. Well, or you could argue that the strategic bombing offensive doesn't tip until late 44. So, actually, into complete dominance. So it takes all this. You're not going to do it in four days for a start, and you're not going to do it in a couple of months over the summer.
But you know, the point you made last week was that this is all incredibly new, and it's incredibly new when you're on the ground. It's incredibly new when you're a Spitfire pilot and you're having to intercept it. You know, you've never seen anything like this before. And certainly the scale of the Battle of Britain, the effort by the Luftwaffe, is certainly bigger than anything that's ever been achieved. Yeah. This is the biggest air battle ever.
Yeah.
And it looks terrifying. And when you, again, you know, when you're on the ground and you're seeing all this stuff come over and you're seeing these contrails and these incredible battles, it looks, you know, it looks like the Battle of Waterloo played out in the air over Kent.
Yes.
But, you know, from the perspective of time, and even from the perspective of just a couple or 3 years of kind of the Second World War, it is very small beer in terms of kind of the scale of what's to come. And the reason the scale is so massively increased is because there's lots of people observing the Battle of Britain from and the Blitz, from Arthur Harris at the Air Ministry coming out on the roof and watching the East End burning, through to Tui Spots coming over as an observer and all the rest of it, and going, you know what, this isn't enough, this is never going to do it. And one of the key people there, Tui Spots, who later commands 8th Air Force, later becomes the kind of, you know, head of Strategic Air Command in Britain in early 1944 for the US, all US... strategic air forces in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, he's learned right from the word go. He's a bomber man, he's an airman, and he comes over and he goes, yep, I can see why people are getting a head up about this, but this is no way near big enough. Yeah. And the Luftwaffe are never going to win. And he's bang on the money.
Well, that's all we got time for. I think we did.
Jesus,
we did.
We've done 48 minutes already.
Yeah, we have, James. We've done it again.
Sorry.
Well, maybe there's going to have to be a Battle of Britain PS in 3 weeks' time or something.
Yeah, or in September or something.
Yeah, in September. Maybe come back to it in September. Let the battle rage and we return to it in September for a sort of final analysis. That was all really, really good. I thought really, really interesting. I've got to go read James's new audiobook, Sicily 43, which, of course, won't read itself. Yeah. Although you can actually get these to read themselves, can't you? You get a strange robot voice, don't you?
Yeah. And now the Panzer Division Hermann Göring
and
into
and Gavin fired at Standartenführer, etc. It doesn't quite work. It doesn't have the kind of dulcet tones you have, that's for sure.
And
very excitingly, I am expecting a finished copy to arrive today.
Brilliant.
It's always a big moment. It's a weird moment with that, with a book, because you get it and it's kind of, you know, it's the one thing that you've been building towards from the moment you kind of write line one in your garret in Cornwall, and then suddenly it comes in, you go, wow, look at that, and you flip through, inevitably find a typo, then feel really grumpy, put it down, and you go, right, well,
what now?
Go on the next one then.
Yeah, well, I sent in my manuscript to the end of last week. But it needs, it actually needs a proper, I need to do a proper comb through and cut some chaff. I know I do, and I know that's the conversation I'm going to have at the end of this week. But I sent it in on Friday, and I rewrote the introduction, and I wrote a postscript for it, and I sent it off, and I got a bounce back, everyone's on holiday, and you think, you fuckers!
No!
You've got the text and you're all on holiday.
Well, congratulations on getting to the end, because it's a big thing getting to the end.
It is a big thing getting to the end. But when it's got jokes in it, and you look back at the jokes and you think, what was I thinking? That doesn't work. Or that's the wrong way around. Anyway, I must go. Great to see you, James.
Yeah, and you. Cheerio, everyone.
Take it easy. Cheerio, everyone.
Bye.